Welcome, friends and listeners. Thank you for being here. I hope you're having a good day. My name is Henrik, and you are listening to Red Eyes Radio, a program that deals with the topics that we are the most passionate about. It does tend to differ quite a bit, but there is some consistency to it, of course, as we talk about hidden agendas, conspiracies, corruption, social engineering, political correctness, and skewing of history by those who are seeking to control us and to have us submit to their tyrannical ways. You can find more at redeyescreations.com and also redeyesmembers.com. We are going to continue our secret space program prep series today. We have Robert Morningstar with us. He is a civilian intelligence analyst and psychotherapist in New York City. He received a degree in psychology from Fordham University, an expert in Chinese language, history, martial arts, and is a FAA licensed pilot and instrument ground instructor with 23 years of flying experience. Robert has studied the paranormal and UFOs for over 40 years and has published many research articles on the internet exposing government cover-up and deception in the JFK assassination. He has also written extensively to expose NASA's use of disinformation technology in suppressing evidence of extraterrestrial life and exposing the real nature of the threat of the UFO phenomenon. He is currently the associate editor of UFO Digest. Our conversation today will go far and wide, from the Dyatlov Pass incident in the Ural Mountains, Russia in 1959, and the UFO connection to that event, to talking about bases on the moon. We'll talk more about the political climate in Europe, and in the extension, religious strife, conflict, control, and a whole lot more. Hi, Robert. Thank you for coming on the program. Nice to have you here. Hope you're doing well today.
It's a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for the invitation.
Now, you're a civilian intelligence analyst and a psychotherapist as well. Tell us about your background a bit more and when you got into the, I guess, more fringe topics of space secrets, studying the anomalies on the moon and everything else that connects you to the topic of the breakaway civilization.
Well, I consider myself an atomic kid, you know. I grew up in the 1950s. I was born in 1948. So I grew up in the atomic age, which turned into the space age after Sputnik. And so as a child, my childhood heroes were two types, real life heroes and media movie heroes. And I think that primarily the first one, first movie hero was Flash Gordon, the Buster Crabbe Flash Gordon of the 1930s, which was being rerun on television as a serial. So I became attached to space adventures with Flash Gordon and Rocky Jones, Space Ranger, shows like that, which stimulated our imagination and our desire to study science so that we would be the vanguard of the space age. So I was always tuned in to the space program because I was involved in UFOs, flying saucers, were a common topic in that period, the atomic age, through the 1950s to 56, 57. And when Sputnik went up, all of us were shocked because we had the myth of the American superiority in all things. And the Russians, we have to give them great credit. You know, there's a big myth about America's achievements being the first, you know. And actually, the Russians were the first on the moon. They landed on the moon. They hit the moon with an ICBM, which worried us, got us on our ICBM project. They landed a lander on the moon. They sent probes that took the first pictures of the far side of the moon, which was then called the dark side. And so I think that they deserve credit. And especially, this is April. We missed the anniversary, but April 12th, I believe, is Yuri's night, Yuri Gagarin. And I've been working on a very interesting UFO case in Russia in which nine hikers were killed in 1959. And I've uncovered a very fascinating aspect of Yuri Gagarin's flight. It wasn't just a propaganda flight. It was a military espionage surveillance flight over the area where these nine hikers had been killed. And they had been killed by UFO activity. They died horrible deaths. And these were very young I would say beautiful, beautiful young people. They were the cream of the crop, you might say, of the Soviet system. They attended a polytechnic institute not far from Smolensk. And this was the area where Yuri Gagarin was raised. So I found a photograph. I found actually a trove, a treasure trove of information, of photographs and KGB files that came from Yuri Gagarin's personal collection.
How did you come over those? That's amazing.
You know, I'm starting to have this, to say this saying, and it pertains specifically to me. And the saying is, I think that God works through Google, in my case. You know, the algorithm that they have, that they study everything you are interested in, and then they present things on your lap.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, a lot of people are against that algorithm because they're afraid that, you know, the government will know too much about what you like. You know, if you surf X-rated sites or controversial political sites, they're going to get on your tail, you know, that kind of thing. But on the other hand, I have to say that I have been blessed by Google several times in the last year in that in studying my preferences, Google has provided me with incredible information that just, as I say, I'm sitting here in front of my monitor in New York City, and it just fell into my lap. And one of these documents was a YouTube video dedicated to this group of hikers and their memory. And this video by D. Romalco contained a book. And this book was the secret report. It was a typed translation of the Russian secret report that was made by the KGB on the deaths of these nine hikers. And it was given to D. Romalco by the family of Yuri Gagarin. Romalco got in touch with the family because he was very, I mean, this is a tragedy that touched all of the Soviet Union in 1959. You know, when we lose hikers on a mountain or people are lost at sea, the whole world is now on CNN gets attached to, for the example of the airplane.
Sure.
That's lost, right?
Yeah.
So, but for the Soviet Union, this event was such an incredible mystery, and it was a tragedy. When you see the photographs of the funerals of these young people and the grief on the faces of the Soviet people of the time, you understand the magnitude of the tragedy. And so I was curious. So I read this book because what he did was he took video of the pages of the KGB book, including the report from the chief investigator. And he said, these are from Yuri Gagarin's personal collection. And I thought, oh, sure, BS, you know. And then I'm going through it, and all of a sudden I saw a picture, beautiful photograph of Yuri Gagarin playing on the floor with his children. And I said, oh, my God, this is true. That's Yuri Gagarin playing with his children in his living room. So I read the whole thing, and I have a habit now that when I get good information, and if it's in video form, I will take my camera and start shooting off the screen. And I'm very glad I did this. I spent 2 days advancing frame by frame to get each of the frames in this book and the photos.
Is the videos you talked about, are they on YouTube, you said?
It was on YouTube. Yeah. I wrote a wonderful story that people have responded to. Parts 2, 3, and 4 are still to come. But I wrote it. I paid my respects to D. Romalco. I gave the link to his video and all the information. I asked people to go there and read it. And guess what? It's been swept. It's been removed from the internet.
Right, right.
From YouTube.
Robert, I just wanted to let you know there as well that if you do have, I do this all the time because of some, you know, important videos that go up online, a couple of good websites where you can actually download the entire movie, and usually in high definition if the source is available, like keepvid.com, you can just plug in the URL for the video, and that way you can download the whole thing as an MP4 file to your own computer.
Oh, I really need that. Thank you. Lakeep, L-A-K-E-E-P?
Yeah, K-E-E-P is for keeping, and then vid for short for video. So keepvid.com. That's a really good site.
Keepvid. Thank you very much.
Sure,
I really
sure.
appreciate that. There's so much. There's so much that I wish to share, and I can't get it.
Sure, yeah.
It's there. I'll be using it.
So tell us more about the video.
All right. So the video was a translation in type. It looked like very, very old paper. I mean, this happened in 1959. And you know, the first free information in Russia, when it's in Soviet Union, started to circulate in the form of samizdats. Samizdats were personally typed up manuscripts that were Xeroxed and copied and handed about. So this looks to me like one of those samizdats from perhaps the 1970s. So actually, the date, there is a date on it. The information was liberated in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union fell. So there are two very important UFO documentaries related to Soviet UFO activity. And this was one of them, which is the Dyatlov incident. Dyatlov, Igor Dyatlov, was the lead hiker who organized the expedition of the nine hikers. And they went off into the Ural Mountains, never to return. They took photographs of their expedition. These were contained in the file, as well as the Russian-Soviet KGB search and rescue. There was no rescue. There was only search because they were mutilated. They were horribly, horribly killed. And so having...
Wait a minute, they made a movie out of this.
Yes, they did.
Dyatlov right. Pass incident or whatever
that's
it was called.
Right. That's right. Yeah, okay. They made that movie.
That's right.
A very creepy movie about a modern version of people going there to investigate the event and falling into the same trap.
Right, yeah.
So the key to it was this photograph. I'm looking at this collection of KGB and Yuri Gagarin's collection, and I look at this photograph and I go, my God. That photograph was taken from outer space. And then I look more closely and I realize this is the region where the murders happened. This is so this was the purpose for Yuri Gagarin going up, not only to win the space race for geopolitical propaganda purposes, but the military aspect of it was that he flew over the area where this happened and took photographs from space. Then let me tell you about the courage of Yuri Gagarin. He is a singular human being in human history, and we should always remember him and respect him, regardless of ideology. He was a very special man, and special to me. I feel kinship with Yuri Gagarin. I feel like my little brother, you know, for some reason. And I feel great kindness for him and his memory and what he achieved. Let me tell you how brave he was. The Russians were hell-bent on winning the space race, but their landing system was not yet perfected, and they didn't trust it. You know, the Russians land on land, and the Americans, we either land on land with a space shuttle, not anymore, but in the water, softer landing. So what happened was they didn't trust the landing system, which is basically dynamite. The space capsules of the Russians come down, and when they're very close to the surface of the Earth, the radar tells them the altitude, and they detonate explosive, like dynamite, in the four places, the four corners of the landing, and that explosion slows the landing to, it's a hard impact. But they didn't trust it. So they said to Yuri Gagarin, listen, we can't take a risk on losing you on the landing. So what we'd like you to do is do one orbit of the Earth. And when you come in on the descent, we want you to jump out at 23,000 feet. So Yuri Gagarin went through outer space 1 hour and 48 minutes. Then he went over that region where these things happened. He took the photographs. I'm not sure if this photograph was taken from space or from his free fall. It looks from space, actually. It's quite high. Regardless, at 23,000 feet, Yuri Gagarin pops the hatch and jumps out into free space, and he parachuted the rest of the way to Earth. And that's something that nobody or very few people really know.
Yeah, 7 kilometers, 23,000 feet above ground. Yeah. That's why he ejected.
Yeah. So the photograph is fascinating, and it is one of the most unusual patches of terrain that I have ever seen on planet Earth. And I've studied planet Earth from outer space for 30 years or more now. So I'd like to dedicate this interview to Yuri Gagarin and to the Russian people and their achievements in space, and in the hope that it was President Kennedy's hope that through the space program, Russians and Americans would become friends and that we would work together. And unfortunately, the powers that be have exacerbated the conflicts for economic and political gain. And I hope that the Russian people and the American people realize that we are not enemies, that we are friends, and that the enemies are really the political and economic interests that have hijacked our governments and work on their own secret agenda. So that
and the soul of the Russian people, of course, to manage to shine through and not be broken by the communist nightmares. That's quite a bit about the people, you know.
Yeah, I really do admire Russian culture, which is something we may touch a bit later when we discuss the cultural conflicts that are overwhelming Europe.
Yeah, definitely.
But right now, let us stay on the space program and finish this off. So these young people, their bodies were recovered. A great mystery surrounds their deaths. I photographed every piece of information that was in Di Romalco's video, and it's in my archives. And among them were several photographs, many photographs taken by the expedition itself. And in this collection was one photograph that is said, last photograph taken by the hikers. And it shows a really strange, anomalous, bright light, leaving multiple impressions. And it's in pitch black. So all you see is like a spotlight. If a spotlight were racing at you and you took a photograph with a slow camera, you would see multiple images of the spotlight and a streak. So that was one photograph. There was another photograph of a panoramic view of the mountain, Kolat Siliak. A very strange mountain whose name is quite dreadful. They call it the Mountain of the Dead now because so many people have died on it. But in the native language of the region, the name means do not go there. Oh, what's that mountain called? Oh, that mountain is called do not go there. So that would give you a hint, you know? Yeah. But again, when people hear names like that, there's always the challenge, the mystery, you know, and we humans are very curious and we want to know, even if under threat of death, you know, and danger. It seems there are some of us who have this special gene called the high risk gene. We're willing to take high risks in order to get high thrills and great satisfaction. So this is one of the characteristics of American people. That was isolated, actually, by an Israeli geneticist. That he claims that this is what made America, that the people who crossed the oceans were willing to risk their lives to get away from the old order and break out and a breakaway civilization. That was what America was, actually.
Right.
America was the breakaway civilization of the 1600s, 1700s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I will return to this mystery. I will say this. Nobody has noticed until now, my eyes, the eyes of Mars, I call them. God gifted me with these special eyes. I see things deeply, but I see things quickly. I have very fast eyes. Something can be flashed in front of me, maybe for a hundredth to, you know, a hundredth or a 50th of a second. And I can see things that other people don't see. And I remember them. So I go back and I freeze the frame. So this photograph struck me for some reason that I did not know. Why is this photograph so interesting? And I studied it and I go, well, look at that mountain. It's got a huge bald spot on that mountain. You know, on the mountains in Sweden, Northern Europe, the Alps, anywhere you go where anybody does any skiing, you will see bald spots on the mountain where a section of forest has been cut away to make a ski run, a ski jump, ski tracks, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Mountain is denuded, a whole box of it, sometimes for an airfield. I once landed on a mountain in New York where the whole side of the mountain had been chopped down. And to land on this runway, I had to dive down into a valley and climb up and land on the side of the mountain going uphill. And then on the way out, I had to take off the top of the mountain and jump off of it. It's a crazy thing. So, event happens, and I get this photograph, and I go, you know, that's a really big patch of mountain to have been carved out in such a rural area of the Urals, you know, the rural Urals. What a place to be. So I get my work. I do my work in computer enhancement, and I zoom up, and I look in. You know, that something doesn't look right, and something doesn't sound right, because the last bodies of these victims were found under 12 feet of snow. Three and a half to four meters of snow had fallen. And I said to myself, you know, there shouldn't be any nude or denuded part of the mountain if 12 feet of snow had fallen. And it was in the middle of the winter when this happened. It was February, February 1959. So let me look at this closely. And I go and I zoom in and I start my enhancement. And what I thought was a bald patch on the mountain was actually a UFO that was stalking them by day. And this man, whoever shot this photograph, took a picture of it, but it's a panoramic. And the low quality of the film, you know, 1959 Russian black and white film, it made it appear like a bald patch on the mountain. But when I zoomed in and improved the brightness, the gamma levels, the lighting, it is clearly a very unusual UFO, quite nearby. I would say its distance was less than half a mile. And then I start going through the other photographs in this collection, the Ramalko collection, and there were photographs of UFOs that were hovering over Plesetsk, the Russian missile site, the launch complex where Gagarin went up. It was called Plesetsk. And they had photographs of about five UFOs just hovering over the missile base. And as I look at these UFOs, there were various kinds, but there in the foreground was exactly the same shape UFO that had been stalking those hikers. So the UFO issue is a very serious, dreadfully menacing issue to people in government, because world governments operate under the assumption and give the impression that they are all-powerful and all-knowing and in control of everything in their respective domains, being the country, Russia, the United States, our area, our landmass. We are the most powerful country in the world. And yet, UFOs operate in our airspace with impunity. There's nothing we can do about it. And the CIA had a real conflict in 1976, 77, 78, which is now 25 years after Roswell, let's say, about 25 years after.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, they had worked very, very diligently to debunk UFOs, to discredit UFO witnesses, to discredit anybody who had any real knowledge of UFOs, and to paint people as crazy, emotionally unstable, misperceptive. And they lost the support of the American people. And I came across a CIA document called UFO Sovereignty in Our Skies. And it dealt with the problem in 1977, where they looked back, some intelligent analyst in CIA looked back and said, we're in a lot of trouble. We have no resources for collecting the data. We worked so hard at debunking the story at discrediting witnesses, that now no one wants to come forward. No one wants to call police. No one will call us. No one will call the CIA or the FAA for fear of ridicule. We need to establish a network for collection of UFO data around the world and catch up with what we've lost. It's a fascinating, fascinating document called UFO Sovereignty in Our Skies. And it deals with very technical subject, horizontal sovereignty and vertical sovereignty. Horizontal sovereignty is control of the airspace over your nation sideways from coast to coast. Let's say the United States from Atlantic to Pacific, from Canada to Mexico, horizontally, but we're limited by the vertical. Our airplanes, for example, 1950s to 1970s, most our airplanes had to operate in the troposphere. A few of them could go into the stratosphere. But UFOs could outrace us horizontally. And if push came to shove, they would just zip up vertically, straight up into outer space. And it was seen by scrambled interceptors that went out to chase them. They would be zooming in on them at 700 to 1,000 miles an hour, as in Belgium, the Belgian wave. And the thing would just go zip, and in an instant, either going 2,000 miles an hour horizontally, or boom, it's just gone off into outer space vertically. So they call that vertical sovereignty. UFOs have vertical sovereignty. We share horizontal up to a point. So anyway, this document is remarkable in confessing the shortcomings of the CIA UFO program. And so people wonder how UFO Digest and all of these websites now get away with reporting the real UFO news, UFO abductions, and all of the operations that are conducted. It's actually because we are a resource now for the National Security Agency, the CIA, the Department of Air Force, the Department of Navy, the Office of Naval Intelligence. All of them read UFO Digest because that's where they get the real UFO news. It's quite remarkable. It's very very satisfying.
May I ask you about your, a shorter overview assessment point of view here? Then obviously you dropped some hints to it here already, but basically, considering all the things that these kids in Russia up in the mountains, they were killed. We're talking about a situation where we have a real and tangible threat here, correct?
Yes,
and
exactly.
So your assessment here is that they are trying to figure out the phenomena. They're trying to piece the puzzle together. Been fairly bad at it so far, but yes. In this process, they're using other people and interest groups and sites like yours to aid them in the figuring out of what is going on. Is that a good overview?
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yes, I would say it. That's a perfectly coherent overview. And interestingly enough, while Russia and the United States had this antagonistic front, right? The Cold War. There is another school that believes that President Kennedy and Premier Khrushchev really came to an understanding that the real threat to humanity on planet Earth is a faction of UFO power, UFO intelligence that is seeking the destruction of humankind by tricking us into wars against each other. And this was the thing that worried President Kennedy the most for the last year of his life. Nothing concerned him more than nuclear holocaust by mistake. And President Kennedy and Premier Khrushchev, the world owes them a debt of gratitude. There should be some monument somewhere to the two of them together, because it was not only one side that saved the world in 1962. It was the two Ks, the three Ks, KKK, Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Kennedy. The Soviet Union had made the mistake of putting nuclear missiles in Cuba, thinking that we wouldn't know about it. And when push came to shove, Kennedy stood strong and demanded their removal. we came so close to nuclear holocaust because the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the United States military, asked President Kennedy to strike Russia first with a nuclear, first strike nuclear assault. And President Kennedy was utterly shocked that these men would say that to him and to ask him to kill 300 million people. And President Kennedy actually was in such shock that he wept. He sat down in his chair and he started crying and he had no words to say. And at that point, Robert Kennedy stood up and said to General Curtis LeMay and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the National Security Agency, "No, gentlemen, you are not going to turn my brother into Tojo. If we were to do this, we would be no better than the Japanese at Pearl Harbor." And then President Kennedy heard those words and he took strength from his brother's support and he ordered that this not be done and to stand down, because General Curtis LeMay was a war hawk and he had enjoyed, and I really mean the word enjoyed, he enjoyed mass murder. He enjoyed the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He enjoyed ending the war, and he thought that he was going to end a war that hadn't yet started by a first nuclear strike on Russia, and Kennedy stopped him. And I believe that that was one of the reasons within a year that President Kennedy was targeted for assassination and died November 22nd, 1963. The other thing that he had done is during that year, 62 to 63, when he and Khrushchev reconciled that crisis, he put in the hotline, a direct telephone line from Washington, from the White House to the Kremlin. And he spoke several times, 14, I believe it was 14 conversations with Khrushchev. And he discussed the UFO issue because UFOs were tracking in at high speed coming over the Arctic and we felt that they were trying to fool us into believing that the Russians were attacking us in the hope that we would launch a retaliatory nuclear strike against them. So this is my warning. There is a power on this planet that hates mankind. And this power is using economics, politics, and religion to drive us all against each other. Unfortunately, two of the main world religions, Islam and Judaism, are in a death grip. And that death struggle between those two cultures threatens to draw us all into it. And I believe that we should separate ourselves from that.
From that conflict?
From that conflict and from any conflict that threatens the existence of humankind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the trick is to use religion and the name of God to turn people toward a godless path.
Right.
And that is one of the problems, you know. I love Europe. I'm fundamentally European by culture and by nature. But first and foremost, I am American. I am an unhyphenated American. And what I mean by that is there are people that say, oh, I'm Italian-American, I'm Jewish-American, I'm Spanish-American. And that hyphen is a divider. That hyphen did not exist, you know, back in 1961, 62, when Kennedy was president. There were only Americans. But after Lyndon Johnson took over, a divide and conquer philosophy took over politics here. And by dividing the nation along ethnic lines, ethnic groups, they were able, the political manipulators in both parties, were able to manipulate the factions and create unions that would guarantee them election. One of the great objections I have to this system is that it has divided people and alienated us from each other. And to the point where Spanish people today in America don't believe they're white. or Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I take great exception to, you know?
Right.
You know, the Spanish-American culture has been propagandized and mind-controlled since the time of Lyndon Johnson to think of themselves as brown-skinned people. And this is the most racist thing that I can imagine, you know, to create color lines and color barriers.
Sure.
See, I'm Spanish on my mother's side, and I'm, boy, am I a mixture on my father's side. I'm German, English, and I'm half Slavic. My father had a German and English background, and he was born in Serbia. And yet, my father rejected Europe. He rejected the wars. He rejected the Nazis. And instead, he was a man of peace. And in World War II, my father had a Germanic name, English and Germanic name. You find it in both countries. And I believe he did not have the heart to kill Germans or to kill English or to kill anybody. So my father spent World War II as a merchant marine on American. First, he was on European ships, and then he switched to American ships in the 1940s. And he lived out the war, having ships torpedoed out from under him. And later, after the war, he got his own ship and became had a very fast freighter. But my father did not want to kill Germans. He did not want to kill Americans. He did not want to kill Russians. He was a man of peace. He was a psychologist. He always said that. He was a captain of a ship. He says, me, I'm only the captain. But in Spanish, yo soy psicólogo. I'm just a psychologist. That's all I do. And actually, any manager, any leader, any president, any person dealing with a corporation or a business, you really have to be a great psychologist to be a successful businessman or a politician. And I guess that influences what turned me to psychology. But I was interested in parapsychology because my whole family was psychically gifted. It was a fact. My mother, my father were both telepathic. They answered my questions before I asked them. They knew what I was doing, you know, no matter where I was. You know, I could be up to some mischief in some other part of the block or the building. And when I got home, my mother said, that was you, wasn't it? Specifically, I'm thinking of this mischief. There were, in the elevators, there are emergency switches. It used to be a toggle switch. You could just throw it and the elevator would freeze on the floor and this terrible bell like a fire alarm would go off. And we were about 8, 9, 10 years old and summertime and having fun. So my friend says, let's throw the alarm. I said, no, don't do that. Don't do that. No, let's throw the alarm. We're going to have fun. We'll run out on the sixth floor. So we go to this fifth floor. I lived on the second. He lived on the sixth. So he figured if we do it on the fifth floor, nobody will know. So he goes to the fifth floor and he throws the alarm. It rings this bell like a fire in the building. We go running out and we get lost, right? I come back to the house. I walk in and my mother says to me, what were you doing a little while ago? What were you doing half an hour ago? Where were you? I said, I don't know. I was playing, let me see. Oh, I was playing with Louis. And she said, you know, the alarm went off on the elevator. I go, and I got that look on my face. Uh-oh. And she looked at me and she said, that was you, wasn't it? I'm wordless. She says, I knew it was you. And I heard that bell. I heard that bell and I knew it was you. And I said, no, Mom, it was Lou. He wanted to. No, it was you. You were with him. And she punished me. So that kind of knowing, seeing how my mother could know that was happening. And it was every day. And premonitory dreams. Let me tell you something. One of the most amazing premonitory dreams that I have ever had, and it's still so vivid. It was in 1956. I was an 8-year-old boy. And I had a dream, a very vivid dream, that I was watching CBS News and Walter Cronkite was on television and he was saying, ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to inform you that the wreck of the Titanic has been found on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Ireland. And I woke up from the dream and I go, what? It was so vivid. And lo and behold, you know, 30 years later, I turned on the television. It wasn't Walter Cronkite, but that's what they were saying. We have found the wreck of the Titanic at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, somewhere off the coast of Ireland, Newfoundland. So that gift was mine. I was born with it. Many of you, everyone is born with it. But our upbringings are such, and our education is such, that it is discredited during our childhoods. We are told that that is superstition, that is false, that it's not real. And yet, every day, there is a proof. So that field, that faculty, those faculties, that realm of the mind, is the spiritual realm of the mind. If your mind is capable of seeing the future and warning you, I have been warned many times in my life about threats, dangers to my life that were coming. And in a sense, in the dream, I would say, oh God, this is terrible. I'm talking now about a terrible car accident that I was involved in 2002. And in the dream, I was warned that I would be on a highway of death and pieces of cars would be all over the place and the moaning and dying people and screaming, yelling emergency workers. And I was standing in the dream and I was saying, wow. And I saw the accident, actually. And in the dream, I was saying, God is showing me this. God is telling me, look, Robert, this is in your path. It cannot be avoided. You're going to have to deal with it. And if you don't deal with it, there's going to be death on the highway in a magnitude you've never seen before. And if you do it the right way, there will be wreckage. You will survive and you may stop death. That's a very strange dream to have, you know? I saw a white car cutting me off and causing this catastrophic accident. So for several days, I mulled over the dream. And I thought about the theme that the white car had caused this accident. And I happened to drive a white car. So the I Ching tells you, you know, that you can do little things. The I Ching is the oldest book in the world. It's a fortune, if you want to call it fortune telling. I think it's more like a computer. So I consult the I Ching. And the I Ching, you know, says that you can't avoid this, but you can change it. And one of the things the I Ching thinks you can do is that you can change your fate by changing one little detail of a pattern. That if the pattern, let's say, is all white and it's death is the result. White car, death. I decided, you know, if I drive a car of a different color that day, I may change this whole situation. So I didn't drive my white car. I borrowed my mother's gold car, and it was a big station wagon, it was an Astro van, and I went to Brooklyn on the solstice, winter solstice of 2002. And just as it was in the dream, a white car appeared out of nowhere, started cutting off drivers left and right, intentionally trying to cause an accident. I backed off far enough to be the fourth guy in a six-car pileup that was intentionally caused by this guy in the white car, just as I had seen it in the dream. Tuesday, I had the dream. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 3 days later, it all came true. So that faculty saved me and people I love and everybody on that highway. Nobody died. And it was because of the way I took the hit. I took the impact. If I had taken the impact another way and turned my car a certain way, there might have been a gas tank explosion and six cars would have gone up in a fireball. As it was a lot of dents, a lot of fender benders, a couple of people, you know, banged up, had to go to the hospital. Nobody died. So this is the faculty that we all need to pay attention to. It's in us. It's innate. It's the original mind of the human being. The mind that's talking to you right now in words from New York City, That mind has evolved only during the last 10,000 years. And yet mankind has been on this planet for 1.5 million years or more. And something was guiding us to that point in the caves, and then the emergence from the caves 10,000 years ago. And then a consciousness that is steeped in words, a consciousness that is dominated by the left side of the brain, the verbal centers, that now ignores the right side of the brain, where these faculties truly reside. So we are half-brained people, and this half-brained, half-brainedness is causing a lot of problems because we're not using our full potential. We're not even using 1/3 of our full potential. We're still asleep. So my mission on this planet as a civilian intelligence analyst, as a psychotherapist, is to help people wake up and find their minds.
Right.
You are not who you've been told to be. You are not who you've been told to be. And I want people to start defining themselves. Create yourself. Define yourself. Don't be a shadow of something else. Don't be a reflection in a mirror of a fashion statement.
Now, time is running by quick here as well. We should take a break in 5 to 10 here or something like that. But I wanted to plug the conference a bit, before we take a little break here. We obviously want to ask you about your website as well, where people can find more about your work. But give us what are you going to be talking about at the conference, by the way? Give us a little flavor of that, if you will.
Okay. Well, my presentation is going to be on the moon and Mars, and how UFOs are related to all of this this mystery. I'm going to be discussing discoveries that I've made on the moon and on Mars, which will show that NASA has been lying to the world about the true nature of the moon and the true nature of Mars. On the subject of Mars right now, I want to say that in 2003, August 26th, 27th, 28th, Mars came closest to the Earth than it had in 60,000 years. And as a person who had been into astronomy for 20 years, local astronomy here in New York off 24-story high rooftops with my friend Alan, I was looking forward to this with great, great interest. But my friend Alan had moved out of the city, and he was the guy who owned the telescope. So I went out and I bought a very good telescope that had a 128x superplasal lens, so I could see Mars at its closest approach to Earth in 60,000 years. So Mars comes in for 2 or 3 nights. I'm up on my roof, and when Mars appeared in that lens, 128x magnification, let me tell you how close Mars looked. The moon is about 250,000 miles away. Mars was 34 million miles away, but I was looking at it through a superplasal lens that magnified it 128x. So divide 34 million by 128, you find out that I was looking at it as if it were only 271,000 miles away. Now, Mars is twice the diameter of the moon. The moon is about 2,000 miles in diameter. Mars is about 4,000, something like that. So I was looking at something that looked like it was a little farther than the moon, but twice as big as we would see it with the naked eye. But when I looked through that telescope, my mind went into super consciousness. My eyes saw details in this planet that, quite honestly, no human had ever seen before, from the surface of the Earth. And I saw atmosphere. I saw weather. I saw active volcanic activity. I saw the deepest asteroid impact that I have ever seen in studying all the photographs of the moons and the planets of our solar system. Mars was devastated by several huge asteroid impacts. One of them so great that it cracked the planet. It cracked the planet at the area called the Valles Marineris, a trench, a canyon that runs the distance from New York to Los Angeles, 18 miles wide, 4 miles deep. And Beneath it, to the south of it, is the area where it impacted. And this created an impact so deep that the sunlight of the rising sun can't reach the bottom of it until about 10:30 or 11 in the morning. And so when the sun is rising and that face of Mars is facing the Earth, it creates a black spot on Mars that has been seen by astronomers since the time of Percival Lowell. When I saw this thing turning in the sky and look at me, I swear that's what it did. It looked at me. It looked like an eyeball crying a black tear. It looked like Alice Cooper's eye. You know, Kiss? Alice Cooper wears that makeup. He has that black tear. That's what it looked like. It looked like Mars was crying a bloody black tear. And I was scared. I was in dread. In the pit of my stomach, I felt this horrible fear. And I said, oh my God, Mars was killed in one day. That asteroid destroyed the planet in one day. The oceans were thrown out of their beds. The planet was cracked. And all of this ejecta, a tremendous part of Mars, was thrown into outer space by that impact. And the proof of it is in, what is it called? AL84012, the meteorite that was found in Antarctica back in the 1970s. It's an actual piece of Mars. And it's something that was blown into outer space and caught by the Earth after horrendous explosions. The planets that existed between Mars and Jupiter, called in legend Marduk, and in other traditions Lucifer. Lucifer was destroyed, and parts of Lucifer hit Mars. Parts of it hit the Earth, and the asteroid belt is what remains. In the esoteric teachings of the secret societies of this planet, they call it Marduk. Some call it Marduk. Others, the Romans, called it Lucifer, and they associated it with Venus as well. But there was a solar cataclysm in the ancient past which destroyed the ecosystems of Mars and possibly some of the moons of the outer planets. And that's what I'm bringing to the public, that NASA has been lying about the true nature of Mars. And let me tell you how I know. On August 26th, 27th, 28th, I saw Mars with my own real eyeballs. And the next morning, and it was August 28th, that NASA put out a photograph that they claimed was Mars. And it was a Hubble Space Telescope photo. And I looked at it, and I became angry, because I realized it was just a cartoon. It was fake. The air glow had been taken out. The atmosphere had been taken out. The weather had been taken out. The clouds and lightning. Lightning like I hope we never see on Earth. I saw something that I named the Aurora Australoborealis on Mars. The Aurora Australoborealis on Mars are streams of plasma which stretch from the South Pole to the North Pole. They arc across the planet. Like our Aurora Borealis stays locally over the North Pole, imagine a stream of plasma 2,000 miles long, 3,000 miles long, shooting from north to south and back. I saw that. I saw the Hellas Basin steaming. Vapors. That one frightened me. I saw the Hellas Basin on one night, and the next night I saw the Eye of Mars, which I thought was the same thing until I got it all straightened out. I realized the planet had turned just a little bit. These two observations were about 24 hours apart, and it turns out that Mars' day is only slightly longer than our own, so we're turning almost in synchronization. We are 24 hours a day. Mars is about 24.15 in duration. So the next day, the planet turned a little more. And I was looking at another impact. But the one that I saw first was the Hellas Basin. And as I looked at the Hellas Basin, I saw vapors rising out of it. It was a huge pool of white steam, vapor rising out of it, as if an asteroid had just struck. And I had no explanation for what I was seeing. 2 days later, although I wrote about it the next day, I said I saw this. 2 days later, NASA put out a press release saying that the Hellas Basin was a self-contained ocean of CO2, that the pressure in the Hellas Basin is so low that the CO2 becomes like the vapor that you see when you throw dry ice into water. You know, you throw dry ice, it starts to percolate. Mm-hmm. Then you see the white steam. That's exactly what I was seeing, but on a gigantic scale. The Hellas Basin is elliptical and it's 600 miles on the long axis. And it looked to me like it had just hit. So they explained that the winds of Mars are so fast, so rapid, that they put a lid. The winds are moving very fast over the Hellas Basin, and they create a lid which keeps those vapors in condensation, in a condensed state. So they're bubbling and vaporizing. And I saw streams. The surface of this, as the sunlight was hitting it, was giving off streams of rainbow-colored iridescence. At the edges, it would sink and it would rise like a tide, like an ocean, but it was a vapor. And I could see the striations of the sides of the Hellas Basin that looked like the sides of the Grand Canyon. So I saw all of these things. And I realized, what's the point of looking at these NASA Hubble space photographs when they're lying? They took away the air glow. The atmosphere is very thick on Mars. I would say it's about 60 miles high from the air glow. It's a very dynamic, a living planet, very dynamic weather systems. All of that is stripped away. And NASA hides the depth of the Hellas, not the Hellas Basin. NASA hides the actual depth of the area called Solis Lacus. That is where this hole is. It's punch in the eye of Mars. And it was a dreadful sight to see, because I realized that the same thing could happen to Earth at any time. We could all be gone. We could all be gone in one night from what I saw. And that's the warning of Mars. Now, if you want to see this story that I've just told you, look at the movie Mission to Mars with Gary Sinise and Tom Robbins. At the end of that movie, with which NASA cooperated in the production, they walk into the face on Mars and they find a holographic representation of the solar system, which depicts exactly the same story that I have just told you, that I saw the impact and my deductions and inference says Mars was destroyed by several asteroid impacts. And the Martians had to leave. I believe we are the Martians.
Mm-hmm.
We do not belong on this planet. We are not made for this planet. Every other species that's original to this planet has its niche and has been prepared for that niche, from polar bears and their fursuits in the Arctic to badgers and beavers digging burrows, to the most this wonderful creature that we call the cat. The cat is an amazing entity on this planet. And I would say that should man ever foolishly destroy himself, I hope that it's cats who inherit the earth. They are.
I love cats too, by the way. I have a number of them.
You know, we have a cat gene. The human being has a cat gene. We share a gene with the cat, and that faculty is very important. But it's been suppressed. Many of very important genes in our makeup have lain dormant. And what is happening now is that those genes are awakening, and we are remembering who we are. Graham Hancock says a wonderful thing. He says, mankind is a species with amnesia. We don't know who we are, we don't know where we came from, and we don't know, as a result, where we're going. However, I believe that the DNA that we carry is a time capsule. And as if you live long enough, this time capsule erupts and knowledge comes up. And this has been my experience. My DNA erupts and I have knowledge. I have an understanding and I know it, and I know it to be true. Then it puts me in the quest to find the proof. So the knowledge comes before the learning. That's another kind of understanding that that we are capable of accessing, that kind of knowledge. So then I find it, and then I know it, and then I look for the proof. And so I've been working for years and years for proofs for these things that I'm telling you right now. And one of the proofs that I'm going to show at the conference in San Francisco will be the only photograph of the Eye of Mars that has, I'm sure that thousands have been taken, but none have been released. So I'm going to release the photo that I took this year on April 9th of the Eye of Mars. And I will show the world the proof of what NASA has been hiding.
All right. Very good, Robert. That's going to be interesting. Obviously, you'll show images of this and piece together that story for us a little bit more at the conference. I just wanted to mention as well that we're about 9 weeks away. The conference is taking place in June 28th and 29th in San Mateo, California. A number of guests and speakers are going to be there. And the website where you can find more information about this is secretspaceprogram.org. And we'll be talking with all of the speakers here at Red Ice Radio as well from now up to the time of the conference pretty much. And we'll have some more links and info as well from redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. And I'm going to be hosting the conference as well. So that's going to be a lot of fun for me. But that's going to be great, Robert. And also before we take a short break here, please give us some details about your website where people can reach you. Is it the Digest, UFO Digest?
Yes. Dirk van der Ploeg is the publisher, and he and I are co-editors. And together we've built UFO Digest into one of the top resources. But we don't just cover UFOs. We cover the paranormal, the unusual, consciousness. There are wonderful essays and articles there by the top writers in ufology. I would like to point you all to the Dyatlov incident that I started. I did part one there, and I published it. But then this issue with the earthquakes coming and the Martian maelstrom has distracted me. I would like to say that I will also be showing pictures of the far side of the moon. And I'm going to show the world the bridge on the far side of the moon. And I'm not talking about an archaic bridge or a piece of bridge or bridge that's been damaged by meteor impacts or something. No, I'm talking about something that looks of recent vintage, an arched bridge that's between two craters on the far side of the moon, as well as towers, complexes of towers that ring the Mare Orientale. And these are wonderful areas. I discovered these by studying the Luna and Zond photographs. Going back to the beginning theme, Luna and Zond were the first moon probes sent up by the Russians. And their photographs were very dark and grainy, black and white, kind of like Polaroids in a way, that were transmitted by television back to Earth. So I have a great collection of them. And with the technology that we have today, I've been able to improve the quality of the Luna and the Zond photographs to the point where I discovered artifacts in them that then I went to the better resources that we have, Lunar Orbiter and some of our friendly moon probes like the Japanese JAXA, Cayuga satellites, the Chinese moon probe, and I've been able to find these artifacts like the Belopolsky triangles, Ellerman Tower. Ellerman is a crater of the most unusual dimensions. It's got a tower that's 47 miles high on the southern areas of the Mare Orientale. Lunar Orbiter took a photograph of a complex of towers that looks to me like a city made of columnar towers, round towers. Imagine New York City, but with round towers, columns. I found another area of the moon that I call Hiroshima on the moon, an area of vast devastation which leaves remnants of infrastructure, avenues, streets, collapsed buildings. It's all there on the far side of the moon.
All right. Well, Robert, I'll push your pause button right here, and we'll pick up in the second hour before we run out of time here in the first one. So
sure.
Stay with us, Robert. We'll be right back again. Then just reiterating the websites, UFODigest.com. We're going to link up the article, by the way, Robert wrote here about the Dyatlov Pass incident there as well. And also, of course, secretspaceprogram.org. We'll be right back. Stay with us.